From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. President Donald Trump pays his first visit to the Cape Fear region during the 2020 election season this week. His agenda? To declare Wilmington the first official World War II heritage city. But it's an opportune time and place for the Republican incumbent, since North Carolina is a battleground state with a slight Republican lean. It's likely this is only the first of a series of visits from the candidates. North Carolina is also the first state to mail out absentee ballots. The State Board of Election reports slightly more than 500,000 absentee ballot requests since August 30th. Voters have until October 27th to request one. And while there is a clear Republican lean in North Carolina, it's a complicated state. There are nearly 7.1 million registered voters in North Carolina, and a slight majority, about 2.5 million, are registered Democrats. The next highest voter block, at about 2.4 million, are unaffiliated. Registered Republicans in North Carolina number about 2.1. Most of those 7 million plus voters are white. Black voters, as of August, only account for about 21% of the state's registered voters. Other ethnic minorities make up even smaller blocks. Those who identify as Hispanic number just 220,000. Female voters outnumber males by about 500,000. The Cape Fear region leans more Republican than the state as a whole. Most of the registered voters in Brunswick and Pender counties are Republican. Then come the unaffiliateds. Democratic voters are third. New Hanover County is a little more purple with its clear majority. 38% of voters unaffiliated, then Republicans, then Democrats. But the registered R's and D's in New Hanover County are only separated by about one percentage point. So while purple, New Hanover County is probably a bit more magenta than violet. What does all this mean for the presidential election, the U.S. Senate race, and the state and local contest that North Carolinians will decide by November 3rd? Today, we'll unpack those questions with Josh Putnam. He's a political scientist specializing in presidential campaigns, and he's the founder of Frontloading HQ, an elections analysis blog. He's also a contributor to 538.com. Josh Putnam, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks for having me, Rachel.
Help us understand, Josh, North Carolina's so-called Republican lean, where a majority of voters are registered Democrats, then unaffiliated voters, and registered Republicans coming in third. How does that create a Republican lean?
Well, this dynamic is not a new one. Democrats have, for a very long time, outnumbered registered Republicans in the state of North Carolina. When it comes to when people go to the polls, however, there's a disparity there, and that's what creates this, right? That more Republicans are turning out on election day, or as may be the case this time around, election month or what have you. Again, as you mentioned in the introduction, mail-in ballots start going out Friday. So people will be voting here over the weekend, potentially, depending on how quickly they get those ballots get to voters, or certainly early next week. But that's generally what's driven this, right? I mean, what's made up the bulk of the big part of the Democratic Party coalition has been minority voters and lower income voters. And those folks are less likely to turn out to vote on election day than Republicans and better off white voters at that. So that's what creates that disparity.
And then when we kind of zoom into the Cape Fear region, it's pretty clear that Brunswick and Pender counties are solidly red, but New Hanover County is a bit more of an anomaly, with most of its voters unaffiliated, and then R's and D's at 31 and 30% respectively. What does this tell us about New Hanover County's lean?
Well, it reflects, I think, what we see across the whole country, right? Is that the more populous, the more urban an area gets, the more likely it is to lean Democratic, and that's what we see here. You get out to some of the counties surrounding New Hanover, they're more likely to be slightly more rural, though. And in both cases, some of these surrounding counties are certainly growing by leaps and bounds. If we look at some of the census numbers and the tracking of population growth there, but that's the story there, as it's mainly an urban versus rural thing. And again, that's why the president's going to be here, right? One can read that as an effort to gin up his base in the surrounding counties, not necessarily New Hanover, though it is somewhat purple.
Yeah, so why are we seeing more people unaffiliated? Why are more people choosing to be independent voters? It seems almost counterintuitive as our political dialogue is as polarized as it's ever been.
Sure. I mean, from my perspective as someone who studies politics and how the system works and so on and so forth, I think one of the things that I used to bring into the classroom was that, look, if you want to affect change in this country, it certainly helps to be a part of one of the parties. Our system is such that we have two major parties because of the first past the post winner take all system that we have. And as a result, right, to create that change, as I mentioned before, it's better to go through the system. That said, there are a lot of voters that are just turned off by some of the rhetoric that is born out of that polarization that you mentioned before, that has created two very distinct camps, right? One of the things that one can look at in electoral studies anyway is that the parties should create a clear distinction among themselves, and that would be a potentially helpful thing. But it's also developed, I think, this is kind of tribalism that has turned off a lot of people. It's certainly not a new phenomenon that people have been filtering into that unaffiliated status of late, but it has intensified of late.
Have analysts always looked at voter registrations as an indicator of likely election outcomes? I mean, this might sound like, an idiotic question, but was there a time when voters were less predictable despite their party affiliations and you couldn't call a race simply by looking at voter registration numbers?
Registration is not much of an indicator because, again, the name of the game is mobilizing folks to actually turn out to vote. You can register everybody, and that's kind of a prerequisite to be able to participate in the system, but not everyone who's registered obviously turns out to vote. Our numbers nationwide are, in a presidential year, we're lucky to crest above 50%. In an intense year like this year, we may be above 60%. But still, that means that 40% of registrants are not actually turning out to vote. And that's
And
generally what the campaigns are trying to do is to up their numbers as best they can.
right. And so you're looking at it from a national perspective, but for instance, Brunswick County is a good example of what I'm talking about. They're solidly red. Almost 40% of registered voters in Brunswick County are Republican. The next block is unaffiliated, and then Democrats don't even make up a quarter of registered voters in that county, and they have an all-Republican board of commissioners. Republicans are safe in this county, which is why there doesn't seem to be an open question as to the outcome in that county. Does that make sense?
It
Like
does,
it.
it does, and again, that's I hesitate to call it a leading indicator, but certainly there's such an advantage in registration there that it would be nearly impossible for Democrats to find success there, countywide or what have you.
And so when you talk about turnout and how, a huge chunk of registered voters don't turn out, is it still true that turnout largely benefits Democratic candidates?
Not necessarily. Certainly, when you've got that registration advantage, I think the issue that one could point to historically is that it's just easier for Republicans to mobilize their voters. Again, when we talk about low-income voters, minorities in some cases, and there's a significant overlap there in a lot of cases, right? That's just a harder group to turn out than folks that are keyed into the economy, say, and are affected by where the stock market fluctuates and so on. That it's not to say that hasn't or can't change over time, but that's the general dynamic that we see there, that Democrats have to work a little harder, say, to get their folks out to the polls.
We've heard people express quite a bit of skepticism about polls and elections predictions and analysis, understandably, after the big data fail or the big prediction fail of 2016. What is different 4 years later, if anything?
Well, I would gently push back on the notion of a failure. I mean, were there some mistakes that were made in 2016? Yes, there were. But it tended to be on the state level. The national polls really nailed it, right? They're not ones that are going to predict, the national polls, that is, the Electoral College outcome, but they do predict the popular vote outcome. We expect some differences across vote totals and what we're seeing in the polls from on Election Day. Again, the national polls got it pretty well right last time. I want to say that the average was Hillary Clinton ahead by 2 to 4 points, and she ended up winning by 3 points nationally, I want to say. So that's generally what we're looking at there in terms of the polls. But there's also an issue with state-level polls as well. And what they missed in 2016 was weighting by education.
And I'm going to ask you more about that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at the 2020 election with political scientist Josh Putnam of Frontloading HQ. When we come back from this break, we'll also find out who he believes will win the presidential election and the role North Carolina might play in that outcome. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Pandemic restrictions, voting by mail, and continuing protests over policing in America are front and center in the political arena as Americans decide on their next president. Today, we're talking with Josh Putnam, a political scientist specializing in presidential campaigns and elections. He is the founder of Frontloading HQ. He's also a contributor to Nate Silver's 538.com. And Josh Putnam, just before we went to break, you were kind of explaining why it wasn't such a big data fail in 2016, even though many people largely expected Hillary Clinton to beat Donald Trump. But help us understand the variability in data quality when it comes to polling. Which polls are better than others, and what kinds of different data are we looking at, or you, when you...
Sure. Sure. So, I mean, to go back to the point that I was making before the break about the difference between state level and national polls, another big difference there is just the frequency of polling at the national level. We just don't get that on an individual state level. So Michigan was one of those states that did not go as projected in 2016, right? It looked like it was a reasonably safe so-called blue wall state for Hillary Clinton, and on Election Day it was settled by fewer than 100,000 votes in President Trump's favor. But again, what was part of what was missing there was, as I mentioned, right, that the pollsters were not weighting based on education, right? So a lot of what was being missed there were the so-called white working class voters that were kind of a core constituency of the Trump campaign last go round, and as much talked about even bleeding over into 2020 as well. So it's those sorts of things. Again, it's not that it was a big or small. I hesitate to put degrees of the miss there on that. It's just, you know, we we only see these things in hindsight, hindsight being 2020 and so on and so forth. But we've seen some correction for that in 2020 by individual pollsters. That's a good sign. What we're still seeing, though, is this discrepancy in terms of the frequency of polling. There's not a lot of polling at the state level, individual states, relative to what we see at the national level. And that affects our understanding. I think what threw folks off most in 2016, though, if they were following along with some of the projection models and so on and so forth, were reading the odds, basically, right? That there were several sites that said Hillary Clinton had a 99% or greater than 99% chance of winning and didn't. Again, that gets into how they're incorporating polls into those models and other variables as well. But those clearly, again, piggybacking on some of the polls, missed things. You've mentioned my contributions to the 538 website. They've tried to develop a model that kind of hedges a little bit and tries to incorporate some of that uncertainty as well, and had a more conservative estimates. I think Trump's chances were 1 in 4, 1 in 5 around that time. And again, those things happen statistically, right? And I think it speaks to an effort on our part as elections analysts in sharing that with people and helping them to understand that. I think that was probably some of the shortcoming last time. As you see a number like 99%, how could you lose? Well, these things happen, right? If you flip a coin enough times, it's going to gradually come out to 50% heads and 50% tails. That's just how things work. Anyway.
Yeah. And so we know this guy, this history professor from American University, Alan Lichtman. You know, he's gotten a lot of play this year because he supposedly has successfully called the election every year since 1984. And he says he's got 13 keys that without fail have calculated his prediction. What do you think about his 13 keys?
I'm trying to be diplomatic here. I'm not, let's call me a skeptic of the quote unquote method that he uses, right? It's not at all, based in numbers, data. It's just a checklist basically, right? Does the candidate fit this category or not, through 13 different things? The other issue with his thing is he goes back and forth depending on the cycle as to whether he's projecting the Electoral College or the popular vote total. So that's kind of inflated his success rate as well. I think last time I checked, he's got Joe Biden as the projected winner this time, but only by one key, if you will. I don't put too terribly much stock in that. It's pseudoscience. Best.
Gotcha. All right. So I'm going to ask you to give us just the briefest Schoolhouse Rocks version of the difference between, you know, this is, it's probably worth a review because we may have many listeners who haven't really processed the difference between winning the popular vote and the Electoral College since 2016. So before you give us your presidential prediction, the difference between those two votes and what that means and why 2016 saw Hillary Clinton win the popular vote and Donald Trump take the Electoral College.
Right. So, I mean, you know, I think it's best to think of the popular vote in terms of the Senate race or the governor's race here in North Carolina this time. Whoever statewide gets the most votes wins that race. That's not necessarily the case within the Electoral College system on the national level. Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton could win the most votes here in North Carolina, and they will get North Carolina's 15 electoral votes by virtue of that. But that's filtered in different ways across different states. Again, since the Electoral College is built up on top of how the founders put together the House of Representatives and the Senate, every state gets as many electoral votes as they have representatives and senators in Congress. That tends to ever so slightly advantage some rural states. And again, looking back at 2016 and what we're likely to see here in 2020, there's still going to be an urban versus rural divide. Donald Trump may take advantage of that now, and Republicans may take advantage of that now, but that's been something that has advantaged Democrats in the past as well, just based on which party is better representing and or having a part, having the rural part of the country as part of their constituency. But that's basically what's happening there is it's not necessarily a direct reflection of the popular vote. But oftentimes, most often, they go in concert with each other. It's a little frustrating for onlookers, I suppose, to think of you know, what, 2000, we saw the same discrepancy between the Electoral College and the popular vote, and we saw it again just 16 years later. That's a question for our democracy as well, right? If folks view that discrepancy as problematic, then it threatens the legitimacy of our system.
You're listening to Coastline Today. It's Elections Analysis with political scientist Josh Putnam of Front Loading HQ. Josh Putnam, which presidential candidate is likely to win North Carolina, and which one is likely to win the White House?
I'll speak at this through the research that I've done this cycle. It differs from other projection models out there, but having looked at the polls on a, I would say, daily basis, it's certainly that, but it's far more frequently than that. What the polls tell us right now is that North Carolina in particular is among the closest, the most competitive states on the board in 2020. As of last check for me, I haven't looked at it this morning because I haven't incorporated the new data yet, but North Carolina's tipped about 2 points in Joe Biden's direction, and it has been pretty consistently at that level since around mid-June. There's been some fluctuation there, but it's never been something that's been in Trump's column. That said, I don't build into my model a probability rating like other sites do. And there's some wiggle room there, right? That one could say if the polls are off by a little bit, then maybe North Carolina is in Trump's column. I think the take-home message, though, is that, again, North Carolina is among the most competitive states that President Trump and former Vice President Biden are going to be fighting over for the next 63 days.
And so based on that, who is likely to take the White House?
Again, based on my reading of things right now, and again, my model's based mainly on the polls, state-level polls that have been released, and again, that comes with all the problems that we talked about earlier in our conversation. But right now, I've got Biden projected to win the Electoral College with 353 electoral votes. That's with a handful of states that are awfully close, but ever so slightly tipped in his direction.
So I understand that, you know, different political scientists come at this different ways, but there's at least one polling aggregator that takes the results from, I guess, major networks, some full-time analysts, some other polls. They show North Carolina as a toss-up state. Are you say that you think North Carolina slightly favors Biden, but it could go the other way. Does that make it a toss-up?
Absolutely. Okay. No, the way I categorize things is I have been frustrated. I've been doing this since the 2008 cycle. I was frustrated by the toss up rating in general, because we know that it may be close, but at any given point in time, it could be by a fraction of a point or 2 or 3 points favor one candidate or the other. So yes, while North Carolina, again, I say is tipped towards Biden, it's rated as a toss-up on my site. That just means it's within 5 points between the two candidates.
Okay, so that makes sense. And as we look at some of the dynamics that affect the polls, let's talk about now the conclusion of the conventions. Historically, candidates enjoy a bounce in the polls after their respective conventions. Did that happen this year? Is it happening? And why or why not?
It's a great question. It used to be that we had this nice kind of regular rhythm to convention season, right? That the party outside of the White House would hold a July convention. Then a month later, the party in the White House would hold theirs. So you had this elongated period of time where you could see that dynamic take effect, right? That hey, a party has 4 days to do its best PR blitz on the country, right? And you see a jump in the candidates' poll numbers thereafter. And that at least that timeline would have been repeated this time had it not been for the coronavirus pandemic. Democrats had planned on having a July convention. Republicans were to hold theirs in August and did. The location changed, but the date stayed the same. So with them back to back, and this is something that we've seen three or four cycles in this century so far, it makes it more difficult to get a read, especially with that first convention, whether or not there's been a bump for the candidate coming out of that a convention. And typically that, as I said before, is the party that's outside of the White House. So that challenger, if we're talking about the out party candidate running against an incumbent president, usually needs to make the case as to who they are, what they stand for, and so on and so forth. So they have a lot of room to kind of grow. But again, there's so much that's floating around this cycle that is abnormal. We've got two conventions that are back to back. We've certainly got the format in which both of them were conducted. And the early evidence in terms of who was watching these things was that it was down relative to 2016, which is maybe further evidence that the people that were tuning in were either people like me, election nerds, or people who were tuning in to cheer on their team of choice, right? And under those circumstances, we would expect to see very little change in the state of the race. Early indications now that we're a few days beyond the Republican convention are that we just haven't seen that much of a change, and that I think is so far the lesson, and we've still got 2 months to go, but the lesson of 2020 is that it's been a steady race that has, at least since this pandemic, favored the former vice president.
Are there people whose minds need to be changed? I mean, when you look at the rhetoric at the conventions, it does. I mean, you suggested that the audience was, you know, people like you, elections nerds, and the base. So who are the people who need to be swayed at this point? And are there as many of those people that there have been in past elections? Or really, do most people know what they're going to do?
Number one, most people do know, but that tends to be pretty close. So the decisive block are the people who are undecided. I'm glad you layered into your question the idea of how does this look historically? Well, what we know of 2016 was that again, the thing that we heard, I think, most often about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump was that they were the two most unpopular major party nominees in at least the polling era. And that was reflected in poll after poll, whether it was on the state level, national level, or whatever. And that was reflected in terms of the number of people who said they were unsure. It was a really big number. I early on in tracking the polling there, just kind of comparing it to 2012, it was, you know, neither candidate is approaching 50% in states that are competitive. And in a lot of cases, we're in the low 40s, which was a real eye-opening to me. That's not the case in 2020 in the state or national level polling. Donald Trump has been where he's been. Low 40s, mid 40s, depending on the state or the poll at the national level. And Joe Biden has been hovering in the upper 40s and around 50%, if not above it, in some of the most competitive states that we'll be watching for the next few months or couple months. That's the difference, right, is that we have far fewer people, who are saying they are supporting a third party candidate or who are unsure this time around. And it appears, at least on the surface, that Joe Biden has benefited most from that.
According to 538, to which you are a contributor, there's at least some evidence that Trump's racist appeals and dog whistles might be less effective this year than they were the first time around in 2016. What do we know about the appeal of racist rhetoric today?
Well, again, it's a part of our politics and has been in the South forever. Whether they're effective or not, I think goes back to kind of the core constituencies of the parties, right? I think where we've seen some kind of drifting of support is in that white working class group in particular, right? And specifically among women in that group have been trending towards Joe Biden to some extent. Right. And certainly I think the convention last week on the Republicans' part was built around trying to woo some of those folks back into the fold. But I think it also particularly speaks to how effective those messages are to that group. It may not be as effective among women as it is among men.
Yeah. And when we look at other races in North Carolina, Governor Roy Cooper, for instance, who won by a hair against incumbent Pat McCrory in 2016. He was the only Democrat to win a gubernatorial seat over a Republican incumbent that year, and it was such a slim margin of victory, about 5,000 votes, fraction of a percentage point. What will that contest now between the incumbent Governor Roy Cooper and Republican challenger Dan Forrest, how will that likely shake out and why?
Well, again, I'll base my answer to that on the polls themselves, and they have favored the incumbent in this case, right? So Roy Cooper was the challenger last time. It's tough to beat an incumbent. He's the incumbent now, and with that, I think brings that incumbency advantage that political scientists and other analysts bring into this conversation. So I mean, people know Roy Cooper. They see him on a daily basis, right? Dealing with the coronavirus and so on and so forth. And again, I think that's helped him to kind of insulate that lead. It's made Dan Forrest's job that much more difficult.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at the 2020 elections in North Carolina and the Cape Fear region with political scientist Josh Putnam of Frontloading HQ. When we come back from this short break, look at some of the other races in the state and whether and how absentee voting could affect the elections. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The political conventions are over and election 2020 is heating up as voters in North Carolina decide whether to vote in person or by mail. Josh Putnam is a political scientist and the creator of the elections analysis site Frontloading HQ. He's also a contributor to 538.com, and he's joining us today for a look at 2020's unusual circumstances, the continuing protests, the pandemic restrictions, what those are bringing to bear on political dynamics. And Josh Putnam, just in looking at some of the other races North Carolinians will be deciding, the U.S. Senate race with freshman Tom Tillis, Republican, he's faced a great deal of criticism both outside and within his party, and most recently over his failure to wear a mask at the White House for Trump's acceptance speech. And The Hill, last September, this was a year ago, wrote about how he faced boos at a Trump rally in Fayetteville, North Carolina. The Hill also pointed to the lowest approval rating for a sitting U.S. senator, just 33%. Again, that was a year ago. He's facing Democratic challenger Cal Cunningham. And The Hill, of course, now notes that Tillis and Cunningham are locked in one of the tightest Senate races in the country, showing the Democrat, according to Real Clear Politics, up nearly 5 points. The Cook Political Report rates the race as a toss-up. How do you see this race?
I think both of those are right. Again, if we go back to the discussion we had about what's a toss-up in the presidential race, anything that's kind of within 5 points is a toss-up. And right now, again, given the polls that we have access to right now, it looks as if Cal Cunningham has an advantage. Is it one that Tom Tillis can't close, a gap that Tom Tillis can't close between now and November 3rd? No, I would say not. But I think a lot of Tillis's fortunes are going to ebb and flow based on how the presidential race goes. That if Trump is doing well, that he will certainly help Tillis along the way.
Is it even worth talking about U.S. Representative David Rauser and his hold on North Carolina's 7th Congressional District? He's facing Democratic challenger Chris Ward. He's held the seat for three terms. This would be his fourth term. Is it safe to say that's a safe seat?
Given the way the district is drawn, I would find it difficult to imagine the Democrat coming out on top in that race, yes.
Yeah. And we also have a rematch in one of the state Senate races in the Cape Fear region. In 2018, Democrat Harper Peterson beat out Republican Senator Michael Lee. It was a fierce race. He edged Lee out by only 231 votes. It was about a quarter of a percentage point. Senator Peterson is now facing Republican challenger Michael Lee in, again, a pretty fierce rematch for that seat in Senate District 9, which is New Hanover County. How do you expect that to go? And is that kind of emblematic of this, you know, R&D, almost neck and neck political dynamic?
Well, again, when you talk about a close race in 2018 and try and look forward to how that might look, so much depends on some of the uncertainty that we've already talked about in this, and that's pandemic driven, right? One would expect it to be razor thin again as kind of the baseline. That said, so much of this is going to turn on turnout. How able folks at the top of the ticket are at getting their folks out, and how well that translates to down ballot races like that one. Again, Trump wasn't on the ballot in 2018, not officially anyway. He is this time. Joe Biden's on the ballot. And so enthusiasm for or against either of those candidates is going to have an impact on folks that carry that same letter next to their name on the ballot. And that includes races as far down the ballot as this state Senate race that we've been talking about. But yeah, I mean, just as I said before, right, as a baseline, one should expect this one to be a pretty close one.
What role does straight party voting play in all of this in North Carolina?
Well, that one has that option, allows you to get in and out of the polling place that much quicker. Or if it's your a mail-in ballot, it's easier just to mark that one box than have to go through the whole thing. But for folks that are solidly Democratic or reliably Republican, then that gives them the option of just checking the one box. They know that their team or members of their team are good to go, and we'll move on with this. It's maybe some of the folks that are a bit more in tuned and or unaffiliated that would maybe want to look down the ballot and look at those races individually to make some decisions. But again, given the polarized era in which we live, most folks, you know, other than maybe a sliver, 10 to maybe 12% are, you know, reliably independent. That's just a small block, but one that can prove decisive if it ends up turning out to vote.
And so do we know anything about how many people typically employ straight party voting versus going through the ballot? Do we have numbers on that?
I haven't looked at that data in a while to know, to be honest with you, Rachel. That's something I'll have to check on for you.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. So looking at the weird circumstances that surround this year's election, first of all, what do we know about the impact that the pandemic is having, both in terms of how people think about it and the impact on the economy and what that's doing to how people and whether people are voting?
Well, I think what we've seen, at least in terms of kind of the national level, is that it's hardened feelings on the president. Not that they were all that variable to begin with. His job approval numbers have been pretty steady throughout. But that's something that you want to someone that may be in the Trump campaign, you want that to be a little more bendable, I suppose, bring more folks into the fold. But again, that's made their job that much harder. In terms of on the individual level, for folks that are making the decision on how to vote and the make your plan sorts of things that the Democratic Convention was trying to push people to do, that's one that we have, I think, a great deal of difficulty assessing right now. We've got some data on that from states that voted later in the primary process. They were forced to more remote version of voting, whether mail-in or early in-person absentee voting or what have you. And again, that it was a primary and after the ones at the presidential level were decided has meant lower turnout in those contests. And that may or may not be indicative of what we see now. I think folks are much more likely to entertain the mail-in option across the country this time around. But again, it's fortunate that folks have options beyond that to vote in person and to vote on election day. I think the one big thing right now that I'd throw out there as a warning moving forward is to not expect to see results election night as usual, because there are so many mail-in ballots coming in and are very likely to advantage Democratic candidates just based on levels of support for that option. But it's going to take a while to assess who's won races, particularly if they end up being close.
Other than just delays in terms of having the final results, are there other concerns that you think people should have or that are legitimate when it comes to whether all the mail-in ballots will be counted? I mean, do you think that there's any evidence to suggest people might be taking a risk if they use a mail-in ballot versus going in person?
Yes, it is a riskier proposition to vote by mail than it is to vote in person. The extent to which there's a discrepancy between those two, I think, is something that folks that are looking at this election in particular are going to be able to assess after the fact. Unfortunately for us, in September of 2020. That said, right. There are many more opportunities to mess up a mail-in ballot. One, your signature has to match. Two, you've got to, at least in North Carolina, apply to get the ballot in the first place. That requires it going two ways in the mail. Then you get the ballot, and the same thing with that. So there are steps along the way that could potentially spoil a ballot, as it were. It's not to say that you can't mess up if you're voting in person. People do that all the time. But it's at least the data that we have access to now, it's far less prevalent if you're voting in person than if you're voting by mail.
What role do you think the protests over policing in this country and Black Lives Matter activism will play in the election's outcome? Are these protests changing any minds one way or another, or are they merely galvanizing voters, getting them more passionately entrenched in their original positions?
I think it's much more likely to be the latter. I think the evidence coming out of Minneapolis back in May and early June, I think the speculation coming off of that was, well, this is really going to help Trump in Minnesota, or help Republicans in Minnesota. And the polling data that we have access to doesn't really seem to reflect that. That the pandemic concerns, I think, overrode some of that. In terms of what's come of this the Jacob Blake situation in Kenosha, I don't think we have an answer to that yet. We're going to need a little bit more time and some studious survey research to get a better handle on that. But I think it's much more likely to be reinforcing than anything, and particularly with the way that the parties are approaching it. Trump is trying to make it about law and order. The vice president, I think, is trying to give a speech in Pittsburgh earlier this week. Is trying to make it about the tension has been there, number one, but number two is also partially an outcropping and outgrowth of the pandemic itself, the frustration that stems from that.
And the tell-all books that have been coming out from Mary Trump, Melania Trump's ex-friend, Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, are these revelations actually shining any new light on anything for voters, or is this the same sort of thing? They're having the same effect as the nationwide protests. Supporters of the president hear about these things, get disgusted, feel even more loyal. Opponents of the president just find new evidence for their dislike of him.
That's absolutely right. Again, fans of the president are going to dismiss those books as fake news, as the president has done. Folks who are against the president are going to say, yeah, we figured that was going to happen all along. This is the behavior. And you know, folks that are stuck in the middle, and it's a lot of people, right, who don't know what to make of it, just see it as continued noise. And it further kind of muddies the picture.
Yeah. And I want to go back for a second just to the absentee voting in North Carolina. In this state, you can vote absentee for any reason, but are there other states where a voter has to meet some criterion for voting absentee?
Yeah. So Texas is an example, and I'm fairly certain South Carolina fits this bill as well. You have to, Texas in particular, the only way you can get in is an age requirement, right? That folks over 65 can request them. There's some other exceptions as well, but again, it's far more restrictive. You can't just say coronavirus and get an absentee ballot as a result of that. But we have seen across the country a relaxing of that in states that had, say, absentee in-person voting, but added this mail-in option as a result of the pandemic.
Yeah. You have worked on presidential campaigns in the past? As a consultant?
I have not. I've always kept them at arm's length or computer screen's length. I don't know, right? At a distance. That way I could better study them.
Okay, fair enough. So when you think about the difference between what you learned during your pursuit of a PhD in political science versus the biggest experiential surprise for you in real world politics, what was that?
In terms of what I expected and what the outcome was, I would have to say it would be the 2016 election. Following those polls, as I'd done in 2012, I thought that I had a pretty good handle on things. Again, it wasn't until afterwards that we saw there were some issues with some of the state level polling that I rely on for that. That was, I think, the biggest surprise to me. I always build in to my thinking some uncertainty, right? That you know, a 0.23 shift one way or the other could bring a certain state into the mix that we didn't expect. But 2016 was a unique one, right? I think that we tend to see undecideds kind of tending to break one way or the other, or tipping towards one candidate more than the other. And I think what we saw last time was a lot of folks that have in the past been called shy Trump voters did not reveal until election day that they were truly supporting the president. So that stands as a surprise. But again, I've done some work on the 2000 election as well, just looking at that data, and my method would have been similar in that case too. And what that says, or what that suggests, is that in these close elections, right, we're going to get a little bit of uncertainty built into those. We're going to get some results that we don't necessarily expect. Whether we get that in 2020, we're going to see in a couple months.
And that is this edition of Coastline. Josh Putnam of Front Loading HQ, thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely, Rachel. Thanks for having me.
One-stop voting begins October 15th. North Carolina voters can request absentee ballots until October 27th, and Election Day is November 3rd. Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.